I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Last week, President Trump reluctantly signed a bill authorizing new sanctions against Russia, and Russia reacted by saying that the sanctions represent an extreme blow to American presidential power. If it weren't for the anti-Russian Washington establishment holding back Trump, Russia and the U.S. would be on friendlier terms. According to the Kremlin, all of this is harmful to the American people. And that's been the Kremlin's line all along, as long as Trump hasn't turned out to be what they'd hoped for. Since his election, Russia has hoped for improved relations with the country, with our country, including revocation of years of sanctions. For his part, the president has made things easier for the Kremlin and state-sponsored Russian media by dragging his feet on signing the bill into law, calling it unconstitutional and seriously flawed, and not saying anything about Russia's decision to expel 755 American diplomatic staff. This hour, we'll have two journalists with us, Julia Yaffe and Jeet Heer, who will talk about U.S.-Russia relations. And we'll also talk to Yaffe, who immigrated to the U.S. from Russia when she was 7 years old, about changing U.S. immigration policy. And we may start with that very issue. All hour, you are welcome to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Julia Yaffe joins us first, staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers U.S.-Russia relations. And as I said, she immigrated to this country at the age of 7 from Russia. They were fleeing anti-Semitism. She has also written for The New Yorker, Foreign Policy, Politico, and The New Republic. And Julia, thank you very much for joining us. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Let's start with immigration, because you made a lot of headlines when you talked about immigration and what your thoughts are about the new immigration policy, Reforming American Immigration for Strong Employment Act, that was announced earlier, aiming to reduce the number of low-skilled immigrants who are allotted green cards by 50%. You came here when you were 7 years old from Russia. What do you make of this new act?
Well, it's interesting that it goes after legal immigration. We heard a lot about illegal immigration during the campaign from the Trump campaign, and they talked a bit about reducing the number of H-1B visas and other legal ways of immigrating. And it's interesting that they're trying to cut back on legal immigration as well. And it kind of fits with what a lot of people in Trump's orbit, including Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller and other kind of hawks on immigration, have been saying, which is that we just have too many foreigners in the country, or foreign-born people in the country, period, and the country can't absorb them. And this is why we're getting a lot of strife and a lot of people having a hard time getting work, et cetera, and that it somehow comes at the expense of Americans who were born here, which I just think is not true.
Mm-hmm. How would Melania Trump have done under the point system?
I haven't gone through and calculated it, but I imagine not that well. She doesn't have a college degree. She was not a high-skilled worker. I mean, models, especially from Eastern Europe, are a dime a dozen. Furthermore, she came here first on a tourist visa. She modeled first on a tourist visa, which is not legal. And then she was here on an H-1B visa, which is that exact visa category that that's a skilled worker visa that was often used by modeling agencies to bring in foreign-born models. And that's exactly the category that the Trump administration and these two senators who have proposed the act, that's the category of visas they want to reduce. Mm.
And Julia, tell me the story of your family coming to America from Russia.
Well, we came here in 1990 at the very end of the Soviet period, although at the time we, of course, did not know that the Soviet Union was on the verge of collapse. When we left, we were saying goodbye to our family in Russia forever. We were essentially burying each other. We did not think we would see each other ever again. But when we got, you know, again, after a year or two, it became clear that that was moot because the Soviet Union collapsed. But it just showed me how powerful American society is at absorbing people and assimilating them, whether they want to be assimilated or not. And especially when you come here as a kid, you very quickly lose your first language. I've had to work really hard to keep up my Russian. I also, you know, my parents didn't, it's the English requirement also that the, or that the, it, there would be preference given to people who speak English also kind of got at me. I didn't speak a word of English. Now I'm a professional writer. My parents didn't speak much English. They were 30 years old at the time. They are now, my mom is a world-renowned physician and scientist. My father is a computer programmer who works on very, noble projects. You know, my sister didn't speak English. She's now a doctor.
Oh my goodness.
So if we, you know, if we had not been able to come in because we didn't speak English, America would have lost out on two doctors and a writer and a computer programmer.
And you speak English, you would never know that you were speaking Russian for the first 7 years of your life.
Yeah, I mean, it is easier for children to, some people have made that argument, that it is easier for children to learn a language than it is for adults. But, you know, my parents were definitely adults and they learned it and they speak pretty near flawless English now. Again, this argument that people aren't assimilating or that these communities aren't assimilating, that they don't speak English, American culture is very powerful and it, you know, it's impossible to avoid. If you think back to about 100 years when we had the last kind of giant wave of immigration from Italy, from Poland, from the Czech Republic, a lot of these people did not, from Russia, from Ukraine, from Hungary, a lot of these people didn't speak English. They lived in these ethnic enclaves like the Jewish community, for example, in the Lower East Side, or the German communities and the Czech communities in Texas or in the Midwest, the Scandinavians, they didn't speak English. They had their own newspapers in the language of their old country. They, you know, had their folk festivals, etc. They were pretty closed and, again, operated in their native languages. Well, how many Czech newspapers are there in the United States? How many Yiddish newspapers are there in the United States? How many, you know, how many times has it been, you know, people whose, you know, grandparents or great-grandparents came from Poland, how much Polish do they speak now? American society really is good at absorbing people and changing how they speak, how they live, how they view the world. And I think we ought to worry a little bit less about that, about assimilation. And also, I find it, you know, it's kind of harrowing and humiliating to have to constantly be making a utilitarian argument, not just for my own family retroactively, but for future immigrants or refugees, because there's also just a moral argument. To constantly prove how useful we are is, I think, also undermines immigrants' humanity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm also glad that you have expertise in Russia, and let's move on to that right now. Let's talk about, because you have special expertise in this area, how the Russians responded to President Trump's very unusual response to the sanctions. You write, after fighting against the sanctions bill and dragging his feet on it, he issued a reluctant signing statement about the sanction, expressing his concerns with the bill. He said it had problems and was seriously flawed. How did the Russians respond to it?
Well, the Russians picked up that signal and ran with it. Every Russian official who speaks publicly spoke about this and said, look, these sanctions, this law is terrible, it's flawed, and look, even the president, even their own president, thinks it's a terrible bill. So they know what they're doing. They know that they've messed up here. It was interesting to see that even the former president, current prime minister, Dmitry Medvedev, talking about how, you know, this bill basically ends the hope that the Russians had for this new administration. But at the same time, they were all making excuses for Trump, saying, well, he still wants to, you know, have better relationship with us, but, you know, his hands are being tied by this the Washington establishment, which just has a rabid, irrational, very emotional hatred of Russia. They love demonizing the Washington establishment and kind of mirroring the language we see on the right, in the right-wing media and the alt-right media, about how it's, you know, the deep state or these unelected officials fighting a justly elected iconoclastic president on these, you know, novel or perhaps unusual policy stances.
Mm-hmm. Prime Minister Medvedev also said, and I'm wondering if this was especially astute insight into Donald Trump or not, the issue of new sanctions came about primarily as another way to knock Trump down a peg. He said new steps are to come and they will ultimately aim to remove him from power.
Well, I mean, they're kind of watching all our hysteria over the Russia, the story about Russia meddling in our elections and the various investigations going on. You know, well-earned hysteria, might add, but to them it looks like we've lost our mind, and it looks like a conspiracy to them to take down Trump. Again, Russians, especially the Russian government, are very conspiratorially minded, and a lot of this kind of fits their worldview that, you know, the shadowy establishment, the that is going to take Trump down because he's anti-establishment. And again, it's interesting how much it mimics and mirrors things what we hear in the right wing about, you know, how this is the deep state, how they're trying to undermine Trump's legitimacy and his power and trying to oust him. Again, there's a seed of truth to that, because I think there's a lot of people on the left who would like to oust him, but this isn't all a cabal.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any doubt at all in your mind that the Russians tried in a significant way to interfere in our election?
I think they tried. I don't know how successful they were. They obviously tried. The question is, how effective were they, and were they effective enough on the margins to sway anything? And the problem I have with the narrative that we're now all running with is this 12-foot-tall, omnipotent, omniscient Putin, who is capable of plotting these extravagant, highly detailed, intricate plans and perfectly carrying them out, when that's just not true. And how much are we overstating Putin's power to our own detriment? Because Putin didn't give us Donald Trump. Putin didn't give us Fox News and Roger Ailes. Putin didn't give us globalization. Putin didn't give us a lot of the things that created this moment. I think the Russians, where they did act, they amplified existing divisions, existing tensions. I don't think they created a lot of what we're dealing with now, and I think we'd be remiss not to address some of these issues.
Do they have dirt on him?
I don't know.
And what do you make of the Mueller investigation that's looking at mob connections, that's looking at financial interests in Russia, that seems to be really expanding its scope?
I think that's probably the more fruitful avenue, and that's not necessarily part of the election story. That's just part of Trump's financial story and how he was able to get, I think there's probably a lot there, how he was able to get financing at a time when nobody was able to get financing and when nobody would specifically lend Donald Trump money, given his bankruptcies and his reputation in the financial universe in New York, given Russians who wanted to get money out of Russia as fast as possible, in part because it was ill-gotten money. And to what extent was Trump either a willing participant in their money laundering, and to what extent was he just closing his eyes to it and not asking any questions? I think that's going to be a much more fruitful avenue of investigation.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a piece in The Atlantic, "Why Does the Kremlin Care So Much About the Magnitsky Act?" Let's talk a little bit more about that. You've already discussed this. This, of course, was supposedly the meeting of Eric Trump and Paul Manafort and Jared Kushner.
Donald Trump Jr.
Donald Trump Jr., yeah, I'm sorry. And then we found out it was to get dirt on Hillary Clinton to be used in the election. But the Magnitsky Act was mentioned here. What is the background of that act? And why are the Russians so concerned and care so much about it?
So it's unclear. Again, we have two very self-interested parties or camps of parties discussing what happened in that meeting. And it's we still don't really know what was discussed. But both sides, of course, either because they didn't talk about this or out of self-interest, say that they didn't talk about any kind of dirt or compromising information on Hillary Clinton. They say they talked about the Magnitsky Act, which is named after Sergei Magnitsky, who was an auditor in Russia, who was hired by... I'm sorry, this is a very complicated story. And when this broke in the news that this was related to the Magnitsky Act, all of us veteran Russia watchers just collectively groaned because, you know, it was just not the turn we were hoping for, because now we have to explain the Magnitsky Act to all of you. And it's very complicated. So basically, there was a guy named Bill Browder who grew up in Chicago and then was actually the grandson of the head of the American Communist Party in the 30s. And he became one of the largest, basically the largest, foreign investor in Russia. And because of his tactics as a kind of activist minority shareholder, and he was, you know, looking under the wrong rocks or the right rocks, but they happened to belong to, you know, people close to Putin. He was barred from the country in 2005. And his money, his fund, started being pilfered by people that it seemed like were connected to the Kremlin. And he hired Sergei Magnitsky, an auditor, to go through and find where this money was going. And he uncovered a massive corruption scheme by which agents of the state, of the Russian state, basically forged papers of Browder's fund, applied to the Russian government saying, look, we're the new owners of this fund and we overpaid our taxes by $230 million, so can you please issue us a refund? And the Russian state immediately, incredibly quickly, just wired them $230 million, and it, of course, disappeared. And when Sergei Magnitsky went public with this, he was arrested at home in front of his young children before they left for school. He was shuttled around various filthy, horrible prisons around Moscow for about a year. He was under pressure to recant his testimony and died in mysterious but clearly violent circumstances. It seemed like he was just allowed to. He developed pancreatitis and gallstones in prison and was just allowed to die of that condition in horrible, horrible pain. And Bill Browder decided to go after the people who killed this man and the people who pilfered his fund and got the U.S. Congress in the fall of 2012 to pass the Magnitsky Act, which sanctioned people who Browder alleged were involved in this man's death. They were not allowed to come to the U.S. anymore, and their American assets were frozen. This, by the way, was really opposed by the Obama administration at the time. They really didn't want these sanctions to pass. Sound familiar? Because they were trying to get things done with Russia. They were in the middle of the so-called reset of relations with Russia, and they saw how much this was angering the Russians, and they didn't want it to pass. The reason it does anger the Russians is it gets at the very channels that Russian corrupt officialdom, which is often everybody wants these high positions in power in Russia, in government in Russia, because it's access to a lot of money that you can steal. Mm-hmm. And then you have to whisk it out of the country to keep it safe.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And the Magnitsky Act went after these channels by which corrupt Russian officials and business people laundered their money.
Mm-hmm.
So, see, this is why we all groaned, because it's too long of an explanation every time.
Yeah, but thank you. It's a valuable explanation, quite valuable. And what do you make, Julia, of this? I don't want to make this too simple, but it is something to behold the president's admiration for Vladimir Putin. He really doesn't seem to, he kind of likes the guy. He seems to admire him. What's going on with that?
I think it's not just Putin that he admires. He admires Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines, who is a very Trump-like president of the Philippines who has now is behind thousands of extrajudicial killings there. He likes Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the head of Turkey, who's arrested thousands and thousands of journalists and activists because he accuses them, usually wrongly, of plotting against him. He likes General Fatah al-Sisi of Egypt, another strongman. He likes Xi Jinping of China, another strongman. So the pattern there isn't Vladimir Putin and Russia necessarily. The pattern is authoritarianism and his own predilections and preference for kind of an authoritarian style, if not authoritarian substance.
We have time to take a couple phone calls. We're talking about Russia this hour of the program, and we will have two guests with us. Here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Julia Yaffe is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and she covers U.S.-Russia relations. She came to this country with her family at the age of 7 from Russia, and we're welcoming calls again at 800-486-8655. For the Mueller team, for the Senate team, for the House team, for the FBI, for whoever else is looking into the possible connections between the administration and the Russian government, how complicated do you think is this whole investigation? How much material is readily accessible or will have to be really dug for? And how long do you think it will take, Julia?
Oh my gosh, I have no idea. I mean, it's going to be complicated, not least because the Russian state is complicated. It is not the monolith, the efficient monolith we imagine it to be. There's a lot of different camps and clans inside the Kremlin and the various security structures that are constantly competing for resources and Putin's attention. And often Putin doesn't give direct orders. He kind of signals his preference, and then it trickles down the bureaucratic pyramid, and each layer interprets it and overfulfills those orders in a way it sees fit. So when we say the Kremlin wants or the Kremlin did this, we're often eliding some very, very pertinent complications because, again, this gives, on one hand, it gives Putin plausible deniability. On the other hand, there are probably just a lot of people taking initiative on their own in order to get that promotion, to get that bonus, without Putin necessarily knowing about it, so or even ordering it. So we have to kind of keep that in mind, but I think that that's also going to make things a lot harder for the investigators. Mm-hmm. As for how long it will take, I think it's anybody's guess.
Mm-hmm. Are you welcoming in Russia now?
Am I what?
Are you welcome?
Yeah, I was actually just there in the spring. I just came back in April. So, again, it's one of my pet peeves is how people talk about, people tell me, aren't you scared to go there? Do you feel safe? The thing is that they don't usually kill journalists, as we like to believe they do. What they do is they kind of starve them. They make it impossible for them to work as journalists. They shut down all the independent outlets where they can work, and they, people have families, they need to support them, they have mortgages, just like we do. And eventually, if it's too hard to work in a certain field, you'll go elsewhere. So a lot of the kind of the best journalists in the business are no longer in the business. And that's how, again, and that's something that we should keep in mind as we look at this administration's war with the press, is that they're not going to kill and beat up journalists. They're going to put economic pressure on our outlets, on our channels, newspapers, magazines, blogs. I think we're going to see something similar to what Russians are seeing. And again, it's not murder everywhere. It's just shutting down papers or putting pressure on advertisers.
Mm-hmm. Let's take one phone call for you. I know your time was limited. Tony in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I kind of blame the Fourth Estate for letting Trump get a free pass during the whole campaign in his first 6 months of his presidency, because the fact of the matter was they were more worried about the good ratings that Trump would give them when he'd call into their shows or when they'd show him on TV, rather than vetting the guy to see if he was presidential, to see if he had any skeletons in his closet, to see if he was involved in money laundering, and to see what his interactions and what his relationship was with Putin. And that's basically my comment. And if the guests would comment on that and take that a little further.
Thanks, Tony. Sure.
Well, I think that's an interesting comment, Tony, and I think we're hearing a lot of that. But I think, again, the Fourth Estate is not monolithic either, and CNN is not the Washington Post and is not the New York Times. So I would ask Tony, did he read the front page New York Times feature on the absolute mess that was Trump's casino business in Atlantic City? Did he read the stories about Trump not paying contractors? Did he read the amazing reporting that David Fahrenthold was doing in the Washington Post about Trump's foundation and how big of a fraud it was? I think it's all well and good to blame journalists and the media, and certainly we're, busy reflecting and self-flagellating too, but I think a lot of this is also on the viewers and the readers, and because this stuff was out there, it was maybe not as much of it as it was as there was, but it's also on the public and what they, because why are they, the ratings, we act like they're this disembodied thing, but the ratings are people tuning in and people wanting to see this. So in some ways, the CNN and all the cable companies who were showing empty podiums waiting for Trump to speak were just reflecting back what the American viewer and reader wanted. So there is also plenty of blame to go around for the American public. The other thing I want to say is that it's not a coincidence that that we got Trump after a decade of newsroom cuts and the death of regional newspapers all over the country, which were kind of the link between kind of smaller local populations away from, New York and D.C. and San Francisco and L.A., and, the link between those populations and those cities and the a kind of informational source about what was going on there, what were those concerns. And that in part is because of technology. It's in part because of changing reader habits and viewing habits, because people are turning more to Facebook. Again, there's plenty of blame to go around, and I agree that the media shoulders a big part of it, but I think we're not the only ones to blame here. I think the public is to blame as well.
Yeah.
Also, we weren't the ones voting, so.
You do have to wonder why they turned over hour after hour after hour of Donald Trump's speeches at the cable networks. I mean, did the viewers really want to see that many hours of campaign
Well, I
speeches?
Think that if people, I think if people tuned out, again, the comment from your listener was, they were just doing this to get ratings. Again, ratings is not just like a number. It's not a random number that a computer spits out. It's people watching. So if people weren't tuning out and were tuning in to see this amazing show that Donald Trump was, they would have probably switched to something else. The fact that these cable companies have been ratings obsessed was not new in 2016. This is why they show plane crashes for hour after hour after hour and all kinds of salacious things that get people to watch. Again, those are people watching. They're not random numbers. And again, I'd like to separate out CNN from and the cable networks from, print media, which, if people read more and if people read the longer articles and read them critically, maybe we wouldn't be in this situation.
Thank you very much, Julia, for being with us.
Thank you.
Julia Yaffe, staff writer at The Atlantic. She covers U.S.-Russia relations, and she and her family came to the United States when she was 7 years old from Russia. We're going to continue. We're talking about the U.S. and Russia. We've done many shows on this topic, and obviously the issue is going to be with us for some time to come. We'll have a different guest after we pause for just one moment. Senior editor at The New Republic, who's the author of several books, and he has written an interesting piece, which we will discuss, and it is titled "The Democrats' Dangerous War Rhetoric on Russia, Their Hyperbolic Comments Risk Becoming a Self-Fulfilling Prophecy." This is the Ideas Network. Okay, so let us now introduce our next guest, who has a lot to say about to the Democrats. Jeet Heer, senior editor at the New Republic, author of a couple books, co-editor of 8. He's written for The New Yorker, The Paris Review, Virginia Quarterly, and more. And thank you very much, Jeet, for being with us. Hi.
Hi, good to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you with us. So you mentioned a couple people, well, several people in the article. Paul Begala, you mentioned Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal, who are really outraged by what's going on. They have said that they think that we are under attack by a hostile foreign power. What kind of rhetoric about this concerns you deeply, and why?
Well, I think the rhetoric that talks about war and about, I mean, I think Paul Begala on CNN said, you know, we have to blow up the KGB, which, I mean, I wasn't sure how metaphorical he's being, but that suggests, like, that America needs a military response to what Russia has done. And I should begin by saying, like, I mean, I absolutely believe that Russia interfered in the last election, and there's mounting evidence of some sort of cooperation between the Trump campaign and elements of the Russian state. But the question is, you know, like, is the best way to address this to think about it as an act of war and to frame it as a military issue?
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's how they're framing it, or are they talking about a different kind of war, a cyber war?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a rhetorical slippage, and my kind of worry is, you know, like the sort of heated rhetoric can go from one to the other, especially like if it's comes involved with policies. Like, I think that there are real parts of the world where the United States and Russia are in tension, and I think like any administration is going to have problems. And negotiate with Russia. And my sort of worry is that, you know, you might get a situation where, you know, Trump, I mean, actually, this is actually an actuality. Trump himself said, you know, that he could blow up a Russian ship and then people would applaud him. And that would answer the story. So there's a, my real worry is that the kind of language of war, even if used metaphorically, can kind of slip into policy.
You write in your article in the New Republic that the Washington Post had reported in June, and I'm not very aware of this, in late December, President Obama approved a previously undisclosed covert measure authorizing planting cyber weapons in Russia's infrastructure. Can you tell us more about that and whatever happened to that?
Sure. The June initiative, I think that there actually hasn't been is follow-up on that. And I don't know that if, like, the new president, Trump, has continued that policy. I mean, America has I think the plan was that if Russia had continued to escalate in intervention, America could release spyware, as they had actually previously done in Iran.
Talk a little bit about the history of our relationship with Russia. You talk about, for some years, a roughly equal percentage of Democrats and Republicans have considered Russia to be the greatest danger to America. Does that still split pretty evenly, Democrats and Republicans, or not?
No, that actually started to split about 2 years ago in 2014. And right now, 39% of Democrats consider Russia as the greatest danger, whereas only 21% of Republicans do. So Democrats are twice as likely to view Russia as the primary threat. And so, I mean, the broader back history is obviously that there's a great deal of anxiety during the Cold War. It went down around 1990, and Russia was seen as a kind of low-level threat by both Republicans and Democrats. There was a kind of spike in 2006, and I think that has to do with the Russian intervention in Georgia. But then it went down again. And so, but I think in recent years, there's a real division between the two parties, which is the real novelty. And I think there's a couple of factors at work, you know, one of which is that Trump emerged as a sort of leading Republican who advocated a friendlier relations with Russia. But I also think that, like, there's a lot of conservatives, people with right-wing ideologies, that kind of find much to admire in Vladimir Putin. They see him as a strong leader, as someone who's stands up for what they regard as Christian civilization against liberalism and against things like gay rights. And then the Russian state has been actively cultivating sort of conservative support in America. America has brought over people like Franklin Graham, the religious right leader, and members of the NRA into Russia to try to, you know, cement alliances.
And yet you would think that there would be bipartisan condemnation of what they tried to do, and it's pretty universally acknowledged by our intelligence services that they were heavily into trying to influence the election, and that the plans, from what I've read, are that they're going to do exactly the same thing in 2018 and 2020, maybe even with more advanced cyber attacks on power grids, trying to get at voter rolls in various states in the country. That's pretty serious, isn't it?
I think that there's real legitimate worries, and I think that there's a lot of reason for America to upgrade its cybersecurity. And I mean, the way I would kind of frame it is, I think that there's a lot of good things that you should do anyways, whether Russia is there or not. Like, I think that America needs to have a sort of more modernized voting system and the sort of backups in place. I think that's a good thing to have, regardless of what's happening. The other thing I would kind of suggest is a lot of these vulnerabilities are more about America's infrastructure weakness, which makes it vulnerable to, like, an outside power more than anything else. And I think that's where I would hope that you could really get a consensus around that.
We welcome phone calls. Jeet here is our guest, writes for The New Republic, where he is senior editor in his latest piece, The Democrats' Dangerous War Rhetoric on Russia. Let's take some phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Matt in Middleton. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I'm wondering why our government is painting Russia in the same light as they did as the Soviet Union, especially when we have North Korea and China as two potential, North Korea being a lesser potential foe, but with China backing them up, I would think strategically it makes a lot more sense to be friends with Russia in that region and to help back up any time. I mean, we've got a person in North Korea who potentially has nuclear weapons is saying, we're going to annihilate you. And we've got President Vladimir Putin saying, let's be friends and get along here. I don't understand where this misplaced aggression and hostility towards Russia is coming from.
Well, they were trying to mess around with our election.
But I think that, you know, we did that in Israel. We spent $300,000 trying to oust Netanyahu, and we do that in many other countries. I didn't see Russia, you know, having much of an influence other than from potentially a media standpoint. Maybe the media is mad because they're not the only ones who can push a particular viewpoint to people who only consume media. I think that Russia having an interest in seeing who is the next leader is no different than us having an interest in seeing who the next leader of a different country is. So I kind of throw all that out the window.
Yeah, so you don't see a concern about Russia trying to get rid of certain voters, voter registration rolls, dumping people, trying to take down our power grid, trying to mess up elections. That doesn't bother you?
I think that the power grid thing is a canard. Any facility or any private company that would put the ability to spin up or turn off utilities on the public internet essentially should be prosecuted by our government for mismanagement. And then getting a hold of voter rolls, what are they going to do with those other than potentially say, don't vote for this guy?
Take them off the registry. Get rid of voters.
Well, people have to go in person to vote. It's not like somebody's coming to your house and saying, I can't vote.
It's, so, you can't, if you're not in the registry, you can't vote. If you go to vote and your name's been taken off the registry because of cyber attacks done by the Russian government, you can't vote.
But when I show up, at least in Wisconsin anyways, and I go to vote, as long as I have my driver's license, it doesn't matter whether I'm on the registry or not.
All right, what do you think about all of this, Jeet? Are they really not our enemies and we should, you know, work with them to take on North Korea and other adversaries?
Well, no, I mean, I think that the for the listener's point, I mean, one area that should worry him is the hacking. I mean, there does like seem to be pretty conclusive good reasons to believe that they hacked both the Democrats and the Republicans and were responsible for release of DNC information. And if they the Republican side is equally worrying because if they hack the RNC and they have documents which they haven't released, that also makes people potentially compromised. So I feel like that's a real concern. I mean, the fact that the United States has intervened elsewhere, well, I mean, many of those interventions were wrong. I mean, they were conducted covertly and they were anti-democratic. So I think we should condemn both. I mean, I'm happy to condemn the CIA intervention in Chile as well as the Russian intervention in America. I think it's profoundly anti-democratic.
And I guess the other question, which we don't know the answer to, is how extensive and how much collusion there may have been between the Trump campaign and the Russians. We don't know yet.
We don't know yet. That's under investigation, yeah. But, I mean, I think what we do know is quite worrying. I mean, like, that the letter that was sent to Donald Trump Jr., you know, indicating support from the Russian state and the fact that, like, leading members of the Trump campaign were willing to go to that meeting, I think it's all very disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes me think of another point. When you talk about the number of Democrats now concerned about Russia, and when you look at what it was like under Ronald Reagan, tear down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev, I guess the question can be asked, are a lot of people, Republicans, who are members of Congress, sort of in agreement with Matt, that this is not a big deal, and, you know, let's be better friends?
I think that there are, I don't know, I mean, I think that the Republican Congress doesn't know what exactly that they're doing, and they're taking a wait-and-see attitude. I mean, there has been some attempts to kind of like, Devin Nunes to kind of like cover up for Trump a little bit, and there are a few Republican congressmen that take a very pro-Russian line, but I feel like many elected officials are genuinely uncertain about how to feel about this, more than they are pro-Russian.
Matt, thanks for the call. Jeremy and Racine, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Uh-huh. I believe that we definitely need to kind of tone down the rhetoric. We also need to be a little diligent at what's going on, but I remember a time when Ronald Reagan was jumping on national television talking about Star Wars programs, shooting nuclear warheads in space. So what's going on with the election, what happened throughout the election, yes, these are something that is vulnerabilities that we have in our election that we need to fix. Let's move forward. Let's be more proportionate in our response. But again, this isn't our first rodeo dealing with Russia. And there's an old saying, an enemy of my enemy is my friend. So we definitely need to work together in this world to combat the more serious threats that are more present going on around the world, like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, et cetera, et cetera.
So do you see us as being able to work with the Russians in Syria, the Russians encountering the threat from North Korea? Jeet?
I mean, I do think that there are areas of commonality. And in fact, I mean, I think the one thing the Trump administration has done is this recent vote for more sanctions in the UN, where they did get Russian support. But I mean, like on a more broad level, like I'm not sure what the basis of that would be. And I think that the Trump administration themselves have a lot of illusions. Like I think people like Steve Bannon kind of imagine that Russia shares their alt-right ideology and wants to have an alliance of the sort of white nations against the Muslims. But I mean, like Putin himself has a much more complicated foreign policy. Russia has a large Muslim population, and Putin is very interested in, you know, acquiring allies in the Middle East. So I think that the ultimate, you know, dream of American-Russian cooperation that that the Trump people have is based on illusion.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest is the author of Peace in the New Republic, where he's senior editor of the Democrats' Dangerous War on Russia. Their hyperbolic comments risk becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is the Ideas Network. Okay, let's go to Joshua in Madison. Hi, Joshua.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have a comment about, you know, I think that it's important to look at Trump's finances, and if any of our leaders owe money to the Russians, which if you believe, I think his son's quote, I think it was a Golf magazine, it talked about a lot of Russian money coming in to pay for their golf courses and various, like, property deals, then that could dictate foreign policy, and that's a terrible thing, you know?
Cheat.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I agree that I think that the finances are going to be the most interesting thing as this story unfolds. I mean, there's ample reason to believe that there are business ties, and I think also that the Trump enterprises did a lot of businesses with various Russian oligarchs, and I think that that more than any sort of ideology might be the underlying story here.
Thank you very much for your call. And we have one more call, time for one more. Rhonda in Appleton, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, the old Russian thing, of course, is quite muddied waters. But more importantly, I think the powers that be have tapped the American public on the shoulder to say, look what the Russians are doing. And in the meantime, we have passed legislation, a.k.a. Citizens United, that lets the 1% of the world buy our elections. Since when did we think that we ever really had a free election in this country, especially when the popular vote does not count?
Okay, thanks for your comments, Rhonda. That brings us just about to the end of the show. I just wonder, in the 30 seconds that remain, Jeet, what stories are you paying attention to? What do you want answers to?
Well, I think the Mueller investigation is the big one, and it's really going to be a question of both what Mueller uncovers and also what, if anything, Trump does to try to stop the investigation.
Do you think he's going to do that? He's going to fire Mueller?
I don't know if he's going to quite fire. I suspect that it's more going to be he's going to try to undermine the investigation to try to, like, basically say, you know, Mueller is crooked and to try to turn this into a political battle.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you. Good. I'm glad you did. And you can read. Actually, we'll put it on our Facebook page in case you don't get the New Republic. We will put Jeet's story up there about the Democrats, actually, and Russia and their hyperbolic rhetoric on this issue. Thanks very much to Gretchen Brown for doing on-air production, and thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing this particular hour. Stay with us. News is coming up momentarily. I want to remind you that tomorrow our first hour will be really interesting. We'll have the Commissioner Emeritus of Baseball, Major League Baseball, by the C-League will be joining us, followed by Mr. Baseball, Bob Uecker, and then David Axelrod will join us, who's now a fine political analyst. He was a chief advisor to President Barack Obama for a number of years.